Chapter 6. For some time, for what seemed to him a very long time, Jack Aubrey had been fetching the post for Ashgrove Cottage himself. He dreaded discovery, and quite apart from the regular, the all-too-regular packets, a surprising stream of letters came from Halifax by the kind offices of returning men of war, transports, and merchant ships, and these letters, always speaking of an imminent return, kept him in a continual state of apprehension. He was not, he never had been, a model of continence, but his affairs had always been of a warm and cheerful nature, with no vows or protestations, somewhat earthy affairs perhaps of no real consequence, affairs with ladies of a like mind, no hint of seduction, still less of any high romantic frenzy. They were uncomplicated, passing encounters, almost as evanescent as dreams, and with as little tangible result. But this was entirely different. The necessary subterfuge and concealment were extremely distasteful to him, and the probable advent of a noisy, enthusiastic, hysterical Miss Smith was stark nightmare. But what grieved him most was the change in his relationship with Sophie. He could not talk to her with his usual complete openness. The deceit and the small ignoble lies set him apart, and he felt extremely lonely, sometimes quite desolate. In any case, he was no good at lying. He did it clumsily, and the doing filled him with anger. More than once he thought of Stephen Maturin. He understood enough of his friend's occult activities to know that he must often lead a peculiarly solitary, cut-off life, perpetually watching himself, wholly free and candid with no one. He felt for him now. But, he reflected, Stephen's was at least an honourable secrecy, a long, drawn-out, permissible ruse de guerre that could not damage him in his own opinion. He was reading Miss Smith's latest effusions. Three had arrived together, in one of the empty brick buildings by his abortive lead mine deep in the deserted, desecrated wood, when a shadow fell across the doorway. Darting the letter into his pocket, he whipped round with a very stern and forbidding expression on his face, an expression that instantly dissolved into one of lively pleasure.
"Why, there you are, Stephen!" he cried. "I was thinking of you not 5 minutes past. How do you do? How come you here? We had not looked for you this fortnight and more."
"Sophie told me I should find you here," said Stephen. "I called in on my way to London, and I have been sitting with her. She is worried about your health. And you are an ugly colour, sure. Will you show me your arm now?"
"She knew I was here," said Jack, his pleasure vanishing.
"Why, brother, one would think that you entertained the local nymphs in this forbidding bower," said Stephen, with a singularly ill-timed jocularity. "Such guilty consternation I have rarely seen."
"Not at all," cried Jack. "Oh, no."
And he asked after Stephen's voyage, after Diana, his reception in Paris, and the present state of France. Then,
"Will you walk up to the house? I was on my way there with the post. You are staying with us, I trust. You will make the most welcome addition to our tête-à-tête, and we will have some music."
"Alas, I'm on the wing. My chaise is waiting at the door, and I mean to be in town tonight. I have broken my journey to see you. Indeed, I crossed to Portsmouth for the purpose, because I wished to know how you are situated."
"I am situated in bilge water up to the neck, Stephen. There is all this damned legal business. Though your Mr. Skinner is an immense comfort, I'm very grateful for him, and then the Admiralty is being troublesome about payment for the Wachsamheit, and there are some other things."
"I am sorry for that. But what I really meant is how you were situated for a ship. Your plans were undetermined when last I saw you."
"I have none. I refused the Orion, which they kindly offered me as a sort of half-leave on full pay, and having done that, I cannot suddenly ask for another, though as things have turned out, I should give my eye-teeth to be ordered on foreign service, to be right out of the country."
"That is what I wanted to know. Our purposes may suit. There is a possibility that I may have a mission in northern waters. It is no more than a possibility, but if I go, I had rather go with you than with any other. We are used to one another's ways. I do not have to play off any tedious mystifications with you, and I know you to be a rare hand at discretion. That is why I came. I wished to survey the ground and to know what I might suggest in London. May I take it that you would not be unwilling to accompany me, should the mission eventuate?"
I shall be very happy indeed, Stephen.
I must warn you that it is likely to be attended with a certain amount of risk, apart from the dangers of the elements. Have you heard of the fate of the Daphne?
Why, yes, it is common talk. It has not been in the newspapers that I know of, but everybody back from the Baltic speaks of it.
What do they say? I do not know the details.
The details vary, but all the accounts I have heard agree that she contrived to get too close to Groper Island.
Not Grimsholm?
It is all one. We call it Groper Island, just as we say Hogland, or the Belt, or the Sleeve, or Passages, for that matter, or the Groin. It seems that she got too close, probably in a flat calm, with the current setting in as it does in those waters, and that she was within gunshot before she was aware. Otherwise, being a light thing, she would surely have towed into the offing, or even swept. However, what is certain is that they opened fire and sank her. They have 42-pounders perched high on the rock, with furnaces at hand. We used to see them glowing a great way off, and the likelihood is that they sent a red-hot shot into her magazine and blew her to pieces directly, for there were no survivors and no trace of her that I can learn. Only fishermen's tales.
Aye, that must have been the way of it. Well now, this same Grimsholm will probably be our destination. Jack whistled.
A damned uncomfortable destination, too, he said. Shoal waters, ugly short seas, and then when you get there, such batteries. It is like a little Gibraltar, and not so little neither. They have dug themselves in high up there, and they sweep a prodigious scope of sea. If those guns were well served, they could defy a fleet. Broadsides are not much use against well-placed, well-served artillery on a height, that you can play on with a plunging fire of red-hot shot. You know what the tower at Mortella did?
I do not.
Of course you do, Stephen. The Mortella Tower in Corsica. The Martello, as some say. The round tower we have copied by the score all round the coast. It was ordered to be taken in 93 or 94, and although it only had 2 18-pounders and a 6, with 32 men and a young ensign to serve them, Lord Hood sent both Juno and Fortitude in to batter it, while the army landed 1,400 men. Well, the ships battered away for 2 hours and more, and by the end of that time Fortitude had 62 men killed and wounded, 3 guns dismounted, a mainmast shot through and through, her other masts wounded, and the hot shot had set her on fire, so she had to haul off, damned lucky not to have run aground. So if one Martello tower can do that to 2 men of war, while at the same time it keeps off 1,400 soldiers, just think what Grimsholm, much higher, 50 times as strong and with no soldiers to worry about, could do. It will be no picnic.
I do not suppose it is in contemplation to attempt the reduction of the place by brute force, but rather by subtler and, I trust, bloodless means, said Stephen. At least they must be tried first. But now I come to think of it, you are a family man, a man with growing responsibilities, and this is more an employment for an unattached young bachelor. I perfectly understand your reluctance.
If you mean to insinuate that I am not game, began Jack. But I dare say you mean it as a joke. Forgive me, Stephen. I usually see a joke as quick as the next man, but I am a little off colour these days.
They walked along in silence under the trees, and then he said,
You are on your way to town. I have to be in Whitehall the day after tomorrow, about Vaxamite, so let me go up with you now. I should like to see something of you after all this while. We will go snacks for the chaise and stay at the Grapes, and that will kill 3 birds at one blow.
Stephen had been lucky in his carriage. It was unusually quiet and well sprung, and as it ran smoothly over the turnpike road in the darkness, they could talk without the least constraint. The enclosed, and as it were, timeless space moved through a largely unseen world, and detached from it was ideally suited for the free flow of confidence. And presently Jack said,
I do so hope this scheme of yours comes off, Stephen. I have particular reasons for wishing to be abroad, or rather for wishing to be ordered abroad.
Stephen considered this remark. In his younger, poorer days, Jack had often longed to be out of the country to escape his creditors and imprisonment for debt, but this could hardly be the case now. Even if much of it was difficult to realize, he still possessed large remnants of his fortune, and although at the improbable worst his liabilities might prove greater still, only a court could decide upon that, at the end of long, long legal proceedings, and at present his interests were in the hands of a very able man of business who would never allow any sudden clapping of his client into a sponging house.
Yet I understood from Sophie that the first hearing, the mere preliminaries, was not to come up before the middle of next term, he said.
It is not that damned legal business, said Jack. Indeed, sometimes I almost welcome all the endless paperwork. It acts as a kind of... No. The truth of the matter is... Why, the truth of the matter is...
He gave a short account of it and ended.
So, do you see, I hope that if I am ordered abroad, she will not come back here, or at least if she does, that she will not settle just at hand. She spoke of Winchester in her last. You need not tell me I am a scrub, Stephen. I know it very well.
I am not concerned with the moral issue, said Stephen, but rather with what may usefully be done.
He was, in fact, surprised at such an abject degree of moral cowardice in a man whose physical courage could not be questioned. But, he reflected, he was not married. He did not know anything of domestic warfare at first hand, nor of the stakes involved, though he had some notion of the crushing nature of either defeat or victory, and the extraordinarily powerful emotions that might come into play. He loved Sophie dearly, but he knew and had long deplored the jealous, possessive side of her character. The postchaise bowled along. His mind drifted off to considerations on marriage, on the small number of successful unions he had known, and upon the probable balance of happiness and unhappiness, on the advantages and corresponding defects of other systems.
Monogamy seems the only solution, alas, he said to himself, although in a way it is as absurd as monarchy. Heaven forbid that we should fall into the errors of the Mussulmans and Jews.
I will just say this, said Jack, breaking in on his thoughts. Though I know it don't amount to much, I have sent all I could. At least she is not short of money.
A pause, and he added,
That is why the delay over the Vaxamheit is so uncommon awkward, coming at this time when most of what I have is tied up. It affects you too, Stephen. You share in head money and gun money, and seeing that you are pretty nearly the only surviving warrant officer, it should be a tidy sum.
I have a few observations to make, said Stephen, brushing the Vaxamheit aside. I offer them for what they're worth. They may be pertinent. They may be of some comfort to you. In the first place, you must know that in women of an hysterical tendency, like the young person in question, for it would be idle as well as uncandid to feign that I do not know who she is.
I named no names, cried Jack. God damn me, Stephen, if I so much as hinted at her name.
Ta-ta-ta, said Stephen, waving his hand. In women of an hysterical tendency, I say, false pregnancies are by no means rare. All the gross symptoms of the 9 months' disease are to be seen, the tumid belly, the suppression of the menses, even the production of milk, everything except for the result. Secondly, I must tell you, as I told another friend not long ago, that even in the case of true pregnancy, rather better than 12 out of 100 women miscarry. And thirdly, you are to consider the possibility of there being no pregnancy at all, true or hysterical. The lady may deceive herself, or she may deceive you. You would not be the first man to be cozened so. As I understand it, she has in fact made no very strenuous attempts to return, though several packets have gone to and fro, and it cannot be denied that a demand for money has a sadly untoward appearance.
Oh, come, Stephen! What a blackguard thing to say! I know her. She may be rather... She may not be very wise, but she is incapable of doing that. Besides, I have begged her not to come. Not yet. I tell you, Stephen, I know her.
Oh, as for knowing a woman, we read, enter in unto her and know her. Very well, and for the space of that coming together, there is perhaps a true knowledge, a full communication. But after? It was a blackguard thing to say, I admit, but this is a blackguard world in parts, and I should never have said it if I had not reasons to suppose that there might be some truth in it. I assert nothing, Jack, but the lady's reputation is very far from being perfect, as I know from another source, and I strongly advise you to take no decided step until you have some irrefragable, independent evidence of her state, until you have really sifted the matter.
I know you mean it very kindly, Stephen, said Jack, but I do beg you will not say things like that. It makes me feel more of a scrub than ever. I really cannot behave like a thief-taker towards a person who has... "'London Bridge already!' he cried, looking out of the window.
A few minutes later they were at the Grapes, where they had stayed together years ago, when Jack was evading his creditors, for the Grapes lay within the liberties of the Savoy, a refuge for flying debtors. Stephen was a poor man, that is to say he usually lived like a poor man, and an abstemious poor man at that, but he did allow himself some indulgences, and one of these was the keeping of a room in this small, quiet, comfortable inn all the year round. The people were used to his ways, and he was welcome whenever he came. He had cured Mrs. Broad, the landlady and an excellent plain cook, of the mouth hambles, and the boots of a less creditable disease. He could do much as he pleased at the Grapes, and more than once he had brought back an orphan child, a dead orphan child, for dissection, keeping it in his cupboard without adverse comment. Nor was there any comment now when, towards the end of a very late supper of codlings and humble pie, he made an unseasonable call for a coach.
"Do not stir, Jack. We will meet for breakfast, if God allow. Good night to you, sir," he said.
And as he put on his greatcoat, he observed with satisfaction that however Jack might protest Miss Smith's perfect innocence, he had evidently digested at least some of his words, as well as three-quarters of the humble pie. He was now looking brighter by far, scarcely hangdog at all, and he was laying into the Stilton with a fine, healthy appetite. Once again it was Sir Joseph who opened the door.
"Here you are at last. Come in, come in," he cried. "You have heard the news of poor dear Ponsish?"
he asked, showing him upstairs.
"That is why I came back," said Stephen.
"So I hoped. So I have been hoping ever since the telegraph brought your signal. Come, sit by the fire. I will move these papers, forgive the disorder. There is a mort of work in hand. The Americans are giving a great deal of trouble in spite of your splendid work. Half the Spaniards in Wellington's rear are Frenchmen at heart. Things are not going well. And now there is this cruel news from the Baltic. If that emperor of theirs is given a moment's respite, he will bounce up like a jack-in-a-box, and all will be to do again. We have been longing for your return ever since the report came in."
"Do you know what happened?"
"Yes. There was a lack of caution, I fear, and only too well do I remember Ponsish saying that he should take the bull by the horns. The sloop stood in, either underestimating the carry of those great guns or trusting too much in her Danish colours, and before she could even hoist out a boat with a flag of truce, they opened a very accurate fire with red-hot shot. One struck her magazine, and she was utterly destroyed. We should have sent a more experienced commander."
"He was a young man?"
"Yes, just made commander into the Daphne. A very gallant officer, but scarcely 22. Yet even before we had the first rumours and then the confirmation of the disaster, we had grown exceedingly uneasy. From the moment Prussia declared, the island became an object of great significance. But now, with the political situation changing so fast, it has grown even more important. It may be the price of Saxony's defection. If only we could win the king over onto our side, that would deal the French a very heavy blow, perhaps even a fatal blow. But one of his prime conditions is that we should be able to protect him and Prussia by landing on the Pomeranian coast, to cut off the French in Danzig and elsewhere, and to harry their left wing from behind. This we cannot do without Grimsholm. Are you acquainted with the Baltic, Maturin?"
"Not at all," said Stephen, "though I have long wished to know it."
"Then pray study this map. Endless dunes all along here, you see," he said, pointing at the eastern shore. "Shallow water, and with the prevailing westerlies, a bad lee shore. Few good places for landing apart from the estuaries, and the best of those few commanded by this damned island. A meeting of admirals unanimously agreed that even without its protecting shoals, the bad holding ground and the prevailing winds, there was no possibility of taking Grimsholm from the west, from the side of the open sea. And although the senior marine officer advanced a plan for an assault from the east, his scheme called for a powerful squadron of ships of the line to provide a covering fire, to say nothing of innumerable transports and bombs. His estimate of the probable losses was shockingly high, but even if the losses had been acceptable and the chances of success far greater than he assumed, the plan was obliged to be dismissed. We do not possess the men of war and transports to carry it out. We simply do not know where to turn for ships. This wretched American war drains our resources, and every day we have complaints from Lord Wellington that we do not cooperate with him on the north coast of Spain, that the navy is scarcely to be seen, and that the French squadrons in the Bordeaux stream and farther north may attack his dangerously extended lines of communication at any moment. We are terribly short of ships, Maturin, and in this war everything depends on them.
Our new allies, a little help, I collect.
Not at sea. The Swedes and the Russians may be very good soldiers, but it is the sea that decides the issue here. Besides, at this juncture you can scarcely call Bernadotte an ally at all. As you know, he is a slippery customer, a fellow that could give Judas a hint or two, and at present his chief aim is to take our subsidies in order to lay hold of the unoffending Norway. In any case, the Swedes have little in the way of a working navy, nor have the Russians. That is to say, they possess some ships, but they do not know how to manage them. Ever since the English officers withdrew, when those countries became our enemies, they have been quite incapable of handling them. And, in addition to that, they are desperately slow and stupid. There was a Russian admiral at the meeting, and he suggested that we should starve them out. It was represented to him that they had 6 months' victuals in the place. Starve them out with a close blockade, says he again in his execrable French. Starve them out with a 6 months' close blockade, when we did not possess the ships to do it, and when every day is of prime importance, when a week might change the whole face of the Northern War. However, not all foreigners are fools. We have a brilliant young Lithuanian, a cavalry officer seconded to us from the Swedish service, and he has provided us with a great deal of fresh intelligence that will, I trust, enable us to have another go, if you will allow me that low expression, another go with a clearer view of the situation.
Be so kind as to outline your clearer view.
It is very curious. In the last weeks there have been violent changes caused by differences between the groups on the island. I believe the details are in that yellow folder beside you, if you will be so good.
Yes,
he said, putting on his spectacles. Here they are. I remember the last time you asked me about these groups, these organizations. I could not tell you, but there they are. Now I have them. The Catalan force on the island was made up of 3 main bodies, the Liga, the Confederatio, and the Gemandat.
Stephen nodded. He knew them well.
The Liga, the Confederatio, and the Gemandat, you will forgive my pronunciation, Maturin, each under its own leader, and they under the command of a French colonel of artillery. This colonel was called away to the siege of Riga, and in the confusion of events he was not immediately replaced. Great dissensions broke out on the island, and the leader of the most powerful group took advantage of the colonel's absence to assume command, and to send the officers who disagreed with him to the mainland, where they have been drafted into the Spanish Legion. He now refuses to place himself under the orders of the colonel's replacement, Major Le Sieur, on the grounds of Le Sieur's inferior rank and of some alleged irregularity in his appointment by MacDonald. He has written to General Oudinot, stating that as a lieutenant colonel, I fancy he promoted himself, he would rather die than submit to the affront. We have his letter.
Pray, Sir Joseph, what is the name of the now dominant group and of its commander?
The group is the Gemandat, said Sir Joseph, passing the letter, and you will make out his name better from the signature than from my attempt at pronouncing it. He writes like a cat, in any case.
Ramon de l'Estrette et Casadimon.
In some degree Stephen had expected it. The word Gemandat had already raised his heart, and perhaps a half-conscious sight of the handwriting had prepared him, but even so he stared at that familiar yet fantastic signature, his godfather's signature, for a long moment before it became real to him, before phantasm and reality could coincide.
"You know the gentleman?" asked Blaine.
It would have been strange if Stephen had not known him. The relationship was taken very seriously in the Catalonia of his childhood, and he had spent many, many days in his godfather's house. En Ramon was a hero to him then, a most fervent patriot, one who traced his descent in the female line from Wilfred the Shaggy, and who refused to speak Spanish unless he was, as he put it, abroad, that is to say, in Aragon or Castile. A passionate hunter as much at home on the mountain or in the forest as any other predator, and one to whom the boy Stephen owed his first wolf, his first bear, his first imperial eagle's nest, to say nothing of the Desmond and the Jennet, an accomplished horseman, an untiring orator. The heroic light faded somewhat as Stephen advanced in years. En Ramon's pride was seen to contain a fair proportion of vanity. To a more objective eye, his eager desire for preeminence,
to lead rather than to be led, showed as something of a hindrance to the cause of Catalan autonomy. And a truer judgment detected more than a little headstrong foolishness in his godfather. But for all that, Stephen retained a lively affection for him, his harmless delight in finery, his stickling for precedence, and even his more serious flaws did not amount to a great deal when they were compared with his courage, his delicate sense of honour, his generosity, and his unvarying kindness to his godson. Stephen could see him, pacing up and down the cold hall at Ullastret, his long Knight of Malta's cloak sweeping from side to side as he declaimed a poem about the siege of Barcelona in his grandfather's time, when the Catalans and the English under Lord Peterborough routed the Spaniards, a poem which might have been more impressive, though it would certainly have been less touching if the often repeated Peterborough had not so consistently rhymed with mugger. "I knew him," he said with a smile. "How is his garrison usually supplied?" "Sometimes from Danzig, more often from farther down, by Danish vessels. We took one of them very recently, the day the dispatches were sent, but its only cargo was wine and tobacco. I am afraid they are in no need of munitions or essential food. Their storehouses are crammed with biscuit and salt provisions, and they have all the fresh water they could want. At a pinch they could hold out well over 6 months." "Wine and tobacco may not be essential," observed Stephen, "but they are a wonderful comfort to the Mediterranean mind. Now this, I take it, is a plan of the fortification itself?"
"Just so. And these are the emplacements. We owe the maps to the young Lithuanian I mentioned just now, a very active fellow and one of the most remarkable linguists I have met.
He speaks all the Baltic languages, and although he admits that his Estonian and Finnish leave something to be desired, his English is well nigh perfect, and so as far as I can judge is his French. He is an engaging creature, and I am sure you would find him useful. That is to say, if you will consent to go after this inauspicious beginning. It is true that the undertaking is by no means as straightforward as I had supposed."
"Oh, clearly I must go," said Stephen. "There can be no question of that. Indeed, I have already taken the liberty of mentioning this possibility to my friend Aubrey. That is why I was so late. I stopped at his house for the purpose. I had much rather sail with him. I had much rather have him in the background than any stranger. He is a man of great experience, which, as you so rightly observed, is essential for an operation of this kind. A Ulysses by sea, whatever he may be by land, and he is at present both willing and able to go with me."
"I am sure we are very much obliged to you, dear Maturin," said Sir Joseph, shaking his hand. "Very much obliged indeed. As for Aubrey, he would be ideal, always providing we can get round the difficulties of rank. Sea officers, you know, are wonderfully tenacious of their prerogatives, and the vessel we had in mind was only a sloop. But that is a mere detail. I am sure it can be dealt with."
"Tell me," said Stephen, after a silence, "did Ponsish impose any conditions when he agreed to go to Grimsholm?"
"Yes, he did."
"I wonder whether they were the same as mine. For I should require a clear understanding that in the event of my succeeding in the negotiations, the Catalan troops should not be regarded as prisoners of war, but that they should be carried to Spain as free men with their arms and baggage, and treated with proper regards. I should in any case need to be able to promise this, and I should be most unwilling to be disavowed. In fact, I should insist upon a categoric assurance."
"I understand you perfectly. Of course, I cannot give the assurance. That must come from on high. But as Ponsish received an almost identical promise, I have no sort of doubt that it will be forthcoming."
"Good, very good. Have you any more documents that I should see?"
Plans, and appreciations of the military position. Nothing of real interest to you or me. Perhaps we might leave them until tomorrow, when the young man I have mentioned can explain his annotations. He has many talents, but writing a clear hand is not among them. In the meantime, let us have a pot of coffee. I'm longing to hear of Paris and your reception there."
While he was away, Stephen looked round the room. It had changed in some way, and after some moments he realized that the erotic bronzes and pictures had disappeared, and that vases of flowers stood here and there.
"Past 3 o'clock, and a dirty, threatening night," called the watchman in the street below, just as Blaine returned. "Looks mighty like a storm."
They drank their pot. They drank the best part of a bottle of old pale brandy, and talked of Paris. Stephen conveyed their friend's greetings and their presents. Sir Joseph asked civilly after the progress of Captain Aubrey's legal affairs, and rejoiced to hear that his suggestion had been of some use. And then, as Stephen was gathering himself to rise, he said,
"I wonder, Maturin, I wonder whether I might consult you as a physician."
Stephen bowed, settled back in his chair, and said he should be happy.
"For some time past," said Sir Joseph,
fixing the coffee-pot with his gaze,
"for some time past, I have been contemplating marriage."
"Marriage," said Stephen in a neutral tone, for his patient seemed unable to get along, seemed almost to suppose that this was a sufficient description of his complaint.
"Yes," said Blaine at last, "marriage. Liaisons are very well, indeed very agreeable at times, but there is a certain, shall I say, restless sterility about them, and in any case the lady in question is strictly virtuous. Yet perhaps I may have left it too late. Of recent months I have become most painfully aware of a certain, how shall I put it, of a certain want of vigour, of a certain debility, as though I too should sing Vixi puellis nuper edoneus. Is there nothing that physic can do in such a case, or is it inevitable at my age? I have passed Horace's lustre decem, yet I have heard tell of elixirs and drops."
"It is not inevitable at all," said Stephen. "Consider old Pa, the old, old, very old man. He married again, fruitfully, I believe, at 122, and if I do not mistake, he was prosecuted for rape at an even later date. My colleague Beauprin, whom I had the pleasure of knowing in France, was only 80 when he married again, but his wife brought him 16 children. Yet, before I speak as a physician, may I ask you, as a friend, whether you have fully considered the wisdom of reviving these fires? When a man looks about him, surely he sees that in general the pain outweighs the pleasure. Your own Horace begged Venus to spare him. Pace precor precor. Is not peace the greatest good? Calm rather than storms? I once sailed with a young man well-versed in Chinese, and I remember his quoting a passage from the Analects of Confucius, in which the sage congratulated himself on having reached the time of obedient ears, the time at which he could do whatever his heart moved him to do, without the least transgression of the moral law. And Origen, as you recall, struck off the offending member, and returned to purer contemplations undisturbed."
"I quite take your point, and a very cogent point it is. But you forget that I am speaking not of a loose, irregular connection. It is marriage that I have in mind. Yet even if that were not the case, I should still ask for your help. I do not think that I am a man of an unusually warm temperament, a particularly amorous man. When I take off my shoes and stockings, I do not see a satyr's leg. But since this weakness came upon me, I find that I must always have looked at the more personable members of the sex with a certain eye, an appreciative, even a remotely concupiscent, a faintly hopeful eye. And with that eye extinguished, it is as though the spring of life were gone. I had no conception of its importance. You are younger than I am, Maturin, and it may be that you do not know from experience that the absence of a torment may be a worse torment still. You may wish to throw a hair shirt aside, not realizing that it is the hair shirt alone that keeps you warm."
"A Nessus shirt might be more apt," said Stephen, quite unheard.
"And I must remind you that Origen's rash gesture was condemned by the Second Council of Constantinople, together with many of his pernicious doctrines, that although St. Augustine prayed for the gift of chastity, he added the rider, 'But not yet, O Lord,' doubtless feeling that where there was no temptation there was no corresponding virtue, and that the peace of which you speak has a close resemblance to death. We are all Stoics in the grave."
"It shall be as you wish," said Stephen. "Yet before the consultation proper begins, I beg leave to observe that the spectacle of a swimmer who has reached the edge of the maelstrom, who can leave the vexed waters, the whirling turbulence, and who voluntarily plunges back again, is one that would have made my philosopher cry out in wonder."
"Even if we grant that your sage knew the maelstrom, which is extremely unlikely, we cannot push credulity so far as to suppose that he ever met anyone like Miss Blenkinsop. Otherwise we should never have heard so much about these ears of his."
Jack and Stephen did not meet for breakfast. There was no sign of Dr. Maturin at all, and when Jack had twice poked his head in at the door, each time hearing the rhythmical wheeze of a man at peace, he put on his best uniform and walked off to the Admiralty to see whether his appointment might be set forward a day. It might, he found, but the gentleman who received him was one of the civilian officials, and like most of his kind he treated sea officers not indeed as enemies, but as creatures always eager to claim more than their due in employment, promotion, allowances, compensation, prize money, head money, gun money. People to be treated with a distant reserve. Often their claims could be referred to the Navy Office, the Transport Board, or the sick and hurt people for comment or clarification, so that a man without interest might wait a very long time for a satisfactory response, or even any interview at all. And many lieutenants and commanders did so. Yet a fairly senior post-captain was used with more outward deference, and Mr. Soames not only rose to greet Jack Aubrey, but even placed him a chair. After some civil preliminaries, he drew out a folder, opened it, and said, "I am to advert to your action with Vark some height, and in the first place I am to ask you how you can be sure of her identity."
"Why, Captain Fielding of the Nymph reported her off Cape Branco, so when we ran into a ship of the line under Dutch colours almost immediately after, we naturally assumed that she was the same."
"But there being no prisoners and no documentary evidence of any kind, we have no absolute proof that the vessel in question was the Vark Zamheit, as you call her."
Jack made no reply for some seconds. He was beginning to feel extremely angry. Then he said,
"The Leopard, under my command, sank a Dutch 74 in latitude 42 south. The conditions in those waters, with a full gale and a heavy following sea, are sufficiently well known to require no explanation of the fact that no prisoners or documentary evidence can be produced. Why, sir, the moment her foremast came by the board, she broached to and vanished directly. In seas of that kind there is no lying a try, no looking for survivors or documents. A ship must scud or perish."
"I am perfectly convinced of it, sir," cried Mr. Soames,
who could not fail to notice the stern voice and the way Captain Aubrey seemed to swell in size.
"And you will appreciate that I act under direction in dwelling on this point. Departmental rules have to be obeyed, and this is an exceptional case."
"I cannot see where the exception lies," said Jack. "Plenty of enemy ships have been destroyed without a scrap of material evidence to prove they ever swam. I could cite a dozen precedents. The log and the unanimous statement of the officers has always been accepted. It is the immemorial custom of the service."
"I quite agree," said Soames, "but you will forgive me, Captain Aubrey, but in this case the statement of the officers is not quite unanimous. It is that which makes it so exceptional. We have received a communication from your former first lieutenant, in which, among other things, he acquaints us with his impression that the vessel was a Dutch storeship armed en flûte."
"A storeship?" cried Jack. "The man is mad! I may not have seen the Vark Zamheit's name on her stern, but by God I saw her broadside, and tasted it too! A post-captain of my service and seniority not to know a ship of the line when he sees one, not to know a 74 when he engages her! By God, sir, it is monstrous! The man is mad!"
"No doubt, sir, no doubt. But until he is certified insane, we are bound by the rules to take notice of what he says. May I suggest that you procure affidavits from your surviving commissioned officers and warrant officers of wardroom rank? I see that you had Lieutenant Babington, Lieutenant Byron, and the Surgeon Maturin. Come in."
The messenger came in. Admiral Dommett had heard that Captain Aubrey was with Mr. Soames, would be happy to see him when he was at liberty.
"Aubrey!" cried the Admiral. "I am very happy to see you. We were just about to send when we heard you were already here. Here already, in Whitehall. That is what I call a coincidence. You think of a man one minute, and you see him the next. It almost makes you believe in crystal gazers. Well, now, the point is this.
There is a delicate, pressing piece of work that calls for a cool, experienced hand. It was suggested that you might not like being offered a sloop, but I said, "Pooh-pooh! Aubrey don't have to stand on his dignity. Aubrey don't toppet the Great Mogul. Aubrey would take a punt against the enemy so long as there was a gun in it. Ain't I right, Aubrey?"
"Quite right, sir," said Jack. "And I'm obliged for your good opinion of me."
He knew very well that this was the Admiral's idea of deep manipulation. In the circumstances, he did not resent it at all.
"May I ask what sloop, sir?"
"Ariel," said the Admiral. "She is lying at the Nore. You can post down and catch the morning tide. God send the wind stays in the southwest."
"May I not pick up my dunnage, sir, and have a word with my wife?"
"Heavens no, Aubrey. This is an urgent business, as I said. I will telegraph Portsmouth, and they will tell her to expect you back next month with a feather in your cap. But time and tide wait for no man, you know."
"No, sir," said Jack.
And not to be outdone, he added,
"And they say that a feather in the cap is worth two in the bush."
"Aye, so they do. Well, come now, we must not lose a minute. The First Lord wishes to see you."
In far graver, far more measured terms, the First Lord told Captain Aubrey all that he had already heard from Stephen and Admiral Dommett, congratulated him on his escape from America, on having been present at the noble victory, and on his readiness to set formality and his own convenience aside for the good of the service, stated that it was, of course, fully understood that the command of the Ariel in no way represented the board's estimate of Captain Aubrey's merits, and finished by saying that although no promises could be made at this stage, there was a possibility of his being offered one of the new heavy frigates now preparing for the North American station on his return. Captain Aubrey's orders would be sent to him as soon as they were written out, and if he would like to save coach hire, he might choose to travel down with the King's Messenger, who would be setting out shortly after dinner.
"I should have asked when King's Messengers were fed," thought Jack,
walking quickly along the Strand.
"Are they fashionable 8 o'clock coves, or are they not?"
He was not himself a fashionable cove, nor was his stomach. Years of life at sea had trained it to expect its due at the old-fashioned early naval hour, and to cry out when that hour was past. It had been past for some time now, and on entering the Grapes he too cried out,
"Mrs. Broad! Mrs. Broad there! Please to put dinner in hand directly. I faint, ma'am, I fail. Where is the doctor?"
"It is all laid in the snug, Captain, and only waits on the doctor's pleasure. He's upstairs with a foreign young gentleman, talking foreign 20 to the dozen."
"Such a sweet young gentleman," observed Lucy through the hatch.
"If I've told him once," said Mrs. Broad, "I've told him 10 times. No joint, no, nor no fowl will bear such treatment. I will call him again."
"Let me go up, Aunt Broad," cried Lucy, darting from behind the bar.
Jack walked into the snug, seized a piece of bread, and ate it. A few moments later, Stephen came in, followed by a sweet young gentleman, a slim officer in a mauve coat with silver lace. He had surprisingly golden hair, bright blue eyes, large and set wide apart, and a complexion that any girl might have envied. His air was modest, but by no means unmanly. Lucy gazed steadily at him with her mouth open, standing ready to pull out his chair, while Stephen said,
"Allow me to present Monsieur Jagiello, of the Swedish service, Captain Aubrey of the Royal Navy."
Jagiello bowed, blushed, and said that he was deeply honoured, most sensible of the occasion. The meal began. Jack set the young man at his right hand and entertained him with small but civil talk, to which Jagiello responded in fluent, almost perfect English, with only the occasional confusion of V and W or J and Y, that made the native agreeably aware of his superiority. Stephen said nothing, except during a silent pause. Jagiello was carving a fowl. Lucy and Deborah could be heard quarrelling about who should bring the next dish in, and in a quick aside Jack told him
that they had their marching orders.
"So I understand," he replied. "Monsieur Jagiello accompanies us."
"I am heartily glad of it," said Jack,
who had taken a liking to the young man.
"I hope, sir, you are a good sailor."
Before Jagiello could answer, an Admiralty messenger came in, brought by both Deborah and Lucy, and delivered his official packet into Jack's own hands. The messenger had to find his own way out, however, since both girls stayed, to stare at Jagiello in a very simple, moonstruck fashion, until Mrs. Broad's voice called them about their business. Even then they kept coming in and out on one pretext or another. More salt, more gravy. a little mustard. Would the gentlemen like more bread? But at the end of dinner they had a far more valid excuse, since Jack always liked to do foreigners honour in his own country, and his favourite way of doing so was to fill them with as much port wine as ever they could hold, so that while they waited for the king's messenger, the bottles came in, pint after pint, a most surprising number. Jagiello held it very well, but in time his beautiful complexion became pinker, his blue eyes brighter still, and he himself grew musical. He had spoken of English popular songs with an appreciation not far from enthusiasm, and now, after a proper reluctance, he obliged the company with The Lady and Death, in a pure, true-pitched tenor. Chevy Chase followed, and All in the Downs, with Jack's deep voice making the glasses rattle, while Stephen's harsh and disagreeable croak convulsed the maidens, clinging to one another just outside the door. To this nest of singing birds there entered a thin, silent, disapproving gentleman in a sad-coloured coat with stuff-covered buttons and starched white neckcloth, who seemed to have dined on cold vinegar. He put out their gaiety at once, and they followed him into the coach, looking as though they had been detected in a peculiarly shameful fault. Stephen, darting back for a forgotten handkerchief, observed Lucy setting her lips to the edge of the sweet young gentleman's empty glass. The sweet young gentleman's rosy flush faded in the open air. For some time he looked but palely, and it was touch and go whether the lurching and jerking of the coach might not overcome him. But once they were clear of Blackheath, he revived and looked about, quite ready for conversation. He met with no encouragement, however. The king's messenger had taken out a book, and screwing himself round in his corner so that the page caught the light, he screened himself from his companions. Dr. Maturin was deep in a brown study, staring at his toes, and Captain Aubrey was asleep, snoring in a strong, commanding bass. From time to time the messenger made awkward, jerking motions, trying to kick the captain awake without seeming to do so on purpose, but without success. Otherwise there was no animation in the coach at all. The tide flowed up the Thames. The coach ran down towards its mouth. The tide slackened in the pool, and all the close-packed shipping there rode high. The ebb began, and imperceptibly the masts sank lower, while foul, black mud appeared on either side. Yet down at the Nore the tide still had the best part of an hour to run when Jack's boat pulled a zigzag course among the men-of-war towards the Ariel in the twilight. For the last mile over the water it had been apparent that her commander was entertaining. Light streamed from her stern windows, and the sound of a party, a musical party, streamed out with it, while ladies were to be seen dancing on the little quarter-deck, a sight that evidently drew all eyes aboard, since the boat was not hailed until it was within spitting distance, and Captain Aubrey's reception as he came up the side was a sadly bungled affair. He had not told the boat to lie off, to give them time for the proper ceremony, partly because he was in a tearing hurry. He had lost valuable minutes snatching up the bare necessities in Chatham, and partly because, to one whose head was still aching from the grape's port, this slackness seemed inexcusable.
"I had not expected you until the morning, sir," cried the unhappy Captain Draper. "The Admiral spoke of the morning tide."
"I am sorry for that, Captain Draper," said Jack, "but it is the present tide that I intend to take. Pray let the hands be called aft."
The wail and twitter of the boatswain's pipes, the order, "Off hats!" and Jack stepped to the mainmast. While Draper held a lantern for him, he read in a strong, hieratic voice,
"By the Commissioners, for executing the office of Lord High Admiral of Great Britain and Ireland, etc., and of all His Majesty's plantations, etc., to John Aubrey, Esquire, hereby appointed captain of His Majesty's ship the Ariel. By virtue of the power and authority to us given, we do hereby constitute and appoint you captain of His Majesty's ship the Ariel, willing and requiring you forthwith to go on board, and take upon you the charge and command of captain in her accordingly, strictly charging and commanding all the officers and company of the said ship to behave themselves jointly and severally in their respective employments with all due respect and obedience unto you their said captain. And you likewise to observe and execute the general printed instructions, and such orders and directions as you shall from time to time receive from us, or any other of your superior officers, for His Majesty's service. Hereof, nor you nor any of you may fail, as you will answer the contrary at your peril, and for so doing this shall be your warrant."
He had read himself in. The moment he finished, the Ariel changed from a sloop to a post-ship, with J. Aubrey as her captain, whose lawful order it was death to disobey.
"I am truly sorry to bundle you and your guests over the side,"
he said to poor Draper, and then, in a very much louder voice,
"All hands to unmoor ship!"
"All hands to unmoor ship!"
roared the boatswain and his mates, sounding their calls, although the order had been heard from stem to stern, and even as far as the Indomitable, two cables' lengths to windward.
"There is Jack Aubrey getting under way," observed the Indomitable's first lieutenant to her master. "I will lay you a bottle of port. We see some fireworks before he clears the mouse."
"Lucky Jack Aubrey," said the master. "He was always a great one for the guns."
While the hands were running to their stations, and the carpenters pinning and swifting the capstan bars, Jack said to Draper,
"Please to introduce the officers."
They were all there, just at hand. Hyde, the first lieutenant, Fenton, the second, Grimmond, the master, and the rest. Draper hurriedly named them. He was on fire to get his cabin cleared and his mum-chance guests away. Jack stated that he was very glad to see them, begged Draper to make his humblest excuses to the ladies, said,
"Carry on, Mr. Hyde,"
and took up his station near the wheel. Throughout the bustle of getting the guests ready, he stood there, watching attentively. The hands were very conscious of his gaze, and they jumped to their duties as they rarely jumped for young Mr. Draper. They had known he was coming ever since the flag lieutenant had brought a Baltic pilot aboard, together with orders for Captain Draper. The news, coming by way of the captain's steward, had spread through the sloop in rather less than 2 minutes. And although many of the aerials were landsmen or boys, there were quite enough man-of-war's men aboard to tell them of lucky Jack Aubrey's reputation as a fighting captain, while the three or four who had sailed with him magnified it extremely. He ate fire for breakfast, elevenses, dinner and supper. It was his custom to head up defaulters in a cask and toss them overboard. He could do so without let or hindrance, because why? Because he had made £100,000, £200,000, £1,000,000 of money in prizes, and rode in a coach and six. And the poor unfortunate buggers he served in this way were those that took more than 40 seconds to fire their broadsides, or missed their mark. All those who could possibly do so eyed him as they heaved round the capstan bars to the brisk squeaking of a fife, eyed him apprehensively. For he was indeed a formidable figure, standing there, silent, larger than life in the twilight, by the nervous Mr. Hyde, a figure that did not seem in the best of tempers either, one that obviously had the habit of command, a figure that emanated authority. The starboard cable glided in. The afterguard, the marines, and most of the topmen heaved. The others veered out through the larboard hawse. The quartermasters and the forecastlemen coiled the cable, one in tears, stinking of Thames mud. The catfall was overhauled. The fish was clear.
"Up and down, sir,"
called the second lieutenant from the forecastle.
"Thick and way for drying,"
replied Mr. Hyde in his agitation, and then with a nervous glance at Jack,
"I mean, thick and dry for weighing."
The Ariel's best bower broke the surface. The cat was hooked to the ring. Her people clapped on to the fall, ran it up to the cat head and fished it in a most seamanlike manner, and with scarcely a pause the ship began to move over to her small bower, the capstan turning steadily.
"Up and down!"
came the cry, and now for the first time the new captain intervened.
"Mast heaving!" he called,
in a voice calculated for a far larger ship.
"Back and pull! Side boys aft!"
For he had seen that Draper was ready, and he wished him to go over the side in proper style, although it would cost minutes of this beautiful windward tide. This Draper did, to the wail of Pipes, with something like a tear in his eye, and his glum companions mute in the boat. And the moment it was decently clear and pulling for the shore, Jack called,
"Away aloft! Trice up and lay out!"
The topmen raced up the shrouds, ran out along the yards, cast off the gaskets and stood poised there, holding the sails.
"Let fall! Sheet home, sheet home! Man the halyards! Haul, haul! Belay!"
The yards rose, the sheets were tallied aft, the billowing sails stood taut, and the Ariel, surging ahead, plucked her anchor from the ground. The hands at the capstan ran the remaining fathoms of cable in as briskly as the tierers could handle it, and the small bower was catted and fished just as she shaved past the Indomitable, a biscuit's toss to windward, passed between her and her next ahead, and headed out to sea on the tail of the ebb.
"She cast pretty," said the master of the Indomitable.
"It was damned impertinence to go to windward of us," said the first lieutenant. "She would have ruined my fresh paint with the least hint of a check to the anchor."
A few minutes later the Ariel dropped her t'gansels, and Jack said,
"Lay me for the mouse, Mr. Grimmond. There is always some garbage there at slack water."
Up until this time Stephen, Jagiello, and the King's messenger had been standing meekly out of the way, like parcels, by the ensign staff. Jack called the first lieutenant, introduced him, and said,
"Mr. Hyde, we must bestow these gentlemen as well as we can. Dr. Maturin can share my cabin, but you will have to find room to swing two more cots somewhere below."
Hyde looked more anxious still. With a deferential, mirthless smile, he said that he should do his best, but the Ariel was a flush-decked ship. If Jack had not already noticed that she lacked anything but a theoretical quarter-deck and forecastle, that her deck ran without a break from stem to stern, so that although beautiful she was decidedly cramped, he noticed it immediately afterwards when he led his charges below. Long experience had taught him to bend between decks, and without taking thought he ducked as he entered the cabin. Jagiello was not so fortunate. He struck his head against a beam with such shocking force that although he protested that it was nothing, he felt nothing, his face turned deathly white, so that the blood running down it showed even more distinctly. They sat him down on a locker. Even the messenger displayed a glimmering of humanity, and while Stephen mopped him, Jack called for grog, told him that it might happen to anyone, and that he should always watch out for low beams in unrated ships, particularly in French unrated ships. Captain Aubrey did not sit with them long, however. As soon as it became apparent that Jagiello would survive, he went on deck again. The squadron at the Nore was already far astern, Sheerness no more than a looming blur. The Ariel was slipping easily through the calm, slack water, making a good 5 knots with a gentle breeze, her wake as straight as a well-drawn furrow. He took half a dozen turns on the little quarter-deck, looking aloft, looking over her side, getting the feel of her. It was much as he had expected, the feel of a well-built, well-rigged ship, fast, weatherly, and easy in hand. He knew her well, having chased her twice without success when she was still a French corvette, and having seen her often after she was captured, one of the few French ship-rigged corvettes that the Admiralty had not ruined by adding a superstructure, though as usual they had overgunned her, cutting an extra port aside, which probably dulled her fine point of sailing and certainly brought her a little by the stern. A trim little ship, a frigate in miniature, but with a purer, unbroken line. A formidable little ship, too, with her 16 32-pounder carronades and her 2 long 9s. Formidable, that is to say, at close range, a match for anything of her own class, so long as she could get near enough. From the moment she had been mentioned in Whitehall, he had been confident that the Ariel, well handled, would do anything he asked her, within sea reason. What he did not know was the capacities of those who were to do the handling. There were obviously some prime seamen among them. They had unmoored, creditably, and everything on deck was ship-shape and Bristol fashion, except for that stray slab line forward. But the Ariel was obviously short-handed, perhaps 20 below her complement of 112, and there was an undue proportion of boys. Yet the main question was not so much whether they could sail the ship as whether they could fight her guns. He knew nothing of the young men who had had her during the last 2 years, nothing of their standards of gunnery, and since tomorrow might find him at grips with a Dutchman out of the Scheldt, to say nothing of possible French or American privateers farther ahead, and very probable Danish gunboats in the belt, he wanted to know what he should expect, and in view of that knowledge, what tactics he should adopt.
"Come up the sheets, half a fathom, Mr. Grimmond," he said to the master, who had the watch. "We do not want to get there too soon, and perhaps we might have that slab line belayed."
Another couple of turns, and he felt the Ariel slacken her pace, like a soft-mouthed mare gently checked by her rider. The mouse was still quite a fair distance ahead.
"Pass the word for the gunner," he said.
And to the bright-eyed, round-headed young gunner he said,
Master Gunner, tell me the state of your stores.
The Ariel was not very rich, but she was not destitute either. He could afford two or three broadsides, using a couple of half barrels of the inferior White Mark powder. This would exhaust his Admiralty practice allowance for the next 8 months, but as soon as he touched at Karlskrona, where he was to join the Commander-in-Chief Baltic, he would fill her magazines and shot lockers out of his own pocket, as did most captains who could afford it, and who were deeply convinced that accurate, rapid gunfire was the best way of beating the enemy at sea.
"Very well," he said, as three bells struck,
three bells in the last dog watch.
"Mr. Hyde, we will beat to quarters, if you please."
"Beat to quarters!"
cried the First Lieutenant. But there followed a most horrible pause. Nothing of the kind had been expected so late in the day. The drummer was in the head, his breeches down. The drum could not be found, still less made to roar. However, encouraged by the boatswain and his mates, all hands ran to their action stations, and some moments later Jack was gratified with the ludicrous spectacle of the drummer, his shirt tail hanging out, thundering madly to a motionless ship's company.
"Fast drumming!"
roared Mr. Hyde, shaking his fist at the unhappy man. And then, turning to Jack, he said in a quiet, respectful tone, "All present and sober, sir, if you please."
"Thank you, Mr. Hyde," said Jack.
And he stepped forward to the imaginary line that separated the imaginary quarter-deck from the imaginary waist. The Mouse Bank was coming near, and though the light was nearly gone, he could still make out the long line of floating rubbish that gathered there between tides.
"Silence fore and aft," he cried.
There was not the least need. The entire ship's company was perfectly mute, and the only sound was that of the breeze sighing in the rigging, the creak of blocks, and the lap of the water down her side. But this was understood by all to be the only right beginning to the martial litany that ran on, "Cast loose your gun, level your gun, out, Tomkin, run out your gun." No surprise at all in this, but amazement when the captain broke the ritual sequence by saying to the master at the con,
"Lay me within half musket shot of that cask to leeward, Mr. Grimmond."
And then, in a louder voice,
"Prime your gun! The crate on the starboard bow is your mark. From forward, aft, fire as it bears."
A breathless pause, and the flash from the bow 9-pounder lit the sky, almost instantly followed by the starboard carronades in a rippling broadside.
"What did I tell you?"
said the First Lieutenant of the Indomitable to the master. They both stared out northwards. The deep, angry roar reached them, and a moment later the low clouds of the northern sky glowed red again.
"He's put the ship about," said the master.
Again the distant thunder, and now a pause, while the master counted aloud. He reached 70, and once more the long flash lit the sky.
"He will get in the fourth," said the lieutenant.
But this time he was wrong. Jack gave the order,
"How's your guns?"
said,
"A creditable exercise, Mr. Hyde,"
and went below smiling, his headache and ill temper gone.